You ever have God ask you to do something, and at first glance, it seems like no big deal? Right? God says, do this. All right, yeah, I'll do that. The closer you get to it, the scarier it becomes. We are studying the book of Genesis, and we've been following the life of Jacob. And as we've said before, and I hope everyone agrees, that when studying historical books like Genesis, that it is indeed history, and it's not fanciful stories. It really is the account of these people, that if we had a time machine, we'd go back and watch what was happening. That Jacob started off at home, and then decided that he was going to deceive his brother and get his brother's birthright. And although that worked well at first glance, it wound up in him having to leave home for, quote, a few days, unquote, which wound up being 20 years. But God met him on the way out and made him a promise. And I think, let's look at that in Genesis chapter 28. I'm sorry, it's in Genesis chapter 28, down in verse 10. Then Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran. He came to a certain place and spent the night there because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place. He had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. Behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south, and in you and your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. So it was an unconditional promise of God. It was giving Jacob the promise given to Abraham. He said, Jacob, you're the guy, you're the inheritor, not Esau. I'm going to give this to you. This is my promise to you that I will take care of you and I will bring you back. Verse 16, then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place and I did not know it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So Jacob arose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on its top. He called the name of that place Bethel, namely house of God. However, previously the name of the city has been Luz. And Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. This stone which I have set up on the pillar, up as a pillar, will be God's house, and of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. Opinions vary on what was going on here. I happen to think that Jacob really didn't get it at that point. That he was really promising God a conditional. God gave Jacob an unconditional promise, and Jacob gave God a conditional promise. Jacob basically said, God, if you're good to me, I'll be good to you. Yeah, I'll build you a house. I'll give you a tenth of my stuff. I'll serve you. You know, I'll give you that if you do all the things you promise. So 20 years intervene. And then we go down to verse in chapter 29. And Jacob winds up in all of these things that were going on. And he brought Jacob great prosperity. And we get down to chapter 30. And now Jacob decides that it's time to go. Then down in chapter 31, which we had last week, and that's when Jacob reveals that he had a dream down in Genesis 31, verse 11. Then the angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob. And I said, here I am. He said, lift up your eyes and see all the male goats. Verse 13, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land, and return to the land of your birth. So God said, okay, Jacob, here's your job. You got to go. It's time to go. So then in Genesis chapter 32, where we'll be today, Jacob's on the way. He already had met his father-in-law Laban and worked things out with Laban. Now we get down to Genesis chapter 32, verse 1. Now as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. Now we don't know how they met him. We don't know whether it was a dream or a vision or whether they actually appeared to him bodily. Verse 2, Jacob said when he saw them, this is God's camp. So he named that place Mahanaim, which means two camps. I said two camps, namely his camp and God's camp. And Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Yeah, this was the little problem he had. Because Laban was really intolerable. Things were going on with Laban. It was time to go, and God told him to go. So it seemed, I would think, if I was Jacob, because, you know, there have been times in my life where I've fulfilled that cliche of out of the frying pan into the fire. I used to say, I used to change jobs rather less discriminately than I do now. And my catchword then was any port in a storm. However, the port that I was going to oftentimes had tornadoes in it as opposed to just mainly stormy seas. And so I'm sure when Jacob was with Laban, that God's command to leave there and go home sounded like a reasonable thing to do. It sounded like, oh yeah, that's what he wanted to do anyway. But there's this little problem back home. Little problem as in, you know, this big burly guy with, you know, hairy guy with likes to kill things for fun. Yeah, Esau. He had to deal with Esau. So he sent messengers first. He didn't just want to sneak in and hope that Esau didn't notice him. So Jacob learned in that respect that he wasn't going to deceive or try to trick his brother. Verse 4, he also commanded them, saying, thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants. I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight. Quite a different attitude on Jacob than when he left. Jacob tried his very best to take everything away from his brother and to be considered to be the leader over his brother. And even really, Jacob had the right, by the blessing of his father, to claim really dominion over his brother, but he didn't. He came back appealing to his brother as someone who was entering his brother's turf. And he was coming into Esau's country. Coming into Esau's country, he better make sure that he was on good terms with Esau. Verse 6, the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, we came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he's coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. Uh-oh. I'm sure if I were Jacob, the first thing I would think of, man, he's coming out with an army. And that army does not mean me good. So if I were Jacob, I would be panicked. And in fact, he was. In verse 7, then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. And he divided the people who were with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two companies. For he said, if Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. Well, I'm sure you've heard that joke about the two guys out hunting, and they disturb a bear, and the bear starts chasing them, and the two guys are running. One guy turns to the other and says, man, I hope we can outrun that bear. And the other guy says, I don't have to outrun the bear, I just have to outrun you. So that was the idea with these two companies, that the idea was that if Esau comes against that first company, that'll delay him enough that they'll have another company and get away. And he comes against the second company, the first company gets away. So he's figuring this way, Jacob could save half of his possessions. But that also meant that he was kind of thinking that he might lose half of his possessions, including half of his family. So what in the world was he to do? Was he to turn back on his scheming, on his tricking? Was he to have a plan? Was he to have an angle? What was he going to do? In verse 9, Jacob made the right choice. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. So the first thing he did was he turned to God, and he reminded God of his promise to Jacob. You can't hold God accountable to that which he has not promised. In this case, God explicitly commanded Jacob to return to his country, and there was a promise associated. So it's okay to say, excuse me, God, you told me to come back here, and you said that you would prosper me, and I don't see a lot of prospering about to go on. I see some de-prospering that's about to happen, in fact. Verse 10. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant. With my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Where was Jacob, the Jacob who had the angles, the Jacob who had the schemes, the Jacob who had it all under control, who had a plan? And not only a plan A, but a plan B, and a plan C, and a plan D. Well, I guess all that had been beaten out of him over the last 20 years. God had taken him through this journey that finally Jacob was the man that God could use. Finally, Jacob kind of had an idea of what this is all about. And he went out of the land with just a shirt on the back and a staff in his hand. And God had made that promise to him back in Genesis 28 that we read. Now I'm sure Jacob was like, yeah, sure, okay, I'll put up this little stone and pour some oil on it. Then that'll be God's house. God can live there. I think now he understands who God is and what God is all about. And now he's just trying to figure out how to save something of what God gave him. Verse 11, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. So interesting that his first concern wasn't the flocks and stuff. His first concern was his family. Go, Jacob. Go, Jacob. Verse 12, for you said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. Once again, he's reminding God of his promise. You promised me that I would have descendants of the sands of the sea. That can't happen if Esau kills all my family. Verse 13, so he spent the night there. And then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau. And what a present it is. 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, pass on before me and put a space between droves. It's like one of those TV commercials that's hawking some kind of thing, and it comes to the end and it says, but wait, there's more! It's like this first little group would come by, and Esau would, if he was angry, was, you know, storming through the desert, and this first group comes up with, you know, a dozen camels or something. He says, what's this? He says, that's a present. He's like, oh, all right. And then he's maybe a little bit better mood. He storms on a little bit further. And the next drove comes on. He said, what's this? And he said, well, that's also a present for you. And to keep on going and going all the way, it's almost like, you know, one of those treasure hunts or something, that every few steps Esau would come upon another present from Jacob. Verse 17, he commanded the one in front, saying, when my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, to whom do you belong and where are you going, and to whom do these animals in front of you belong, then you shall say, these belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau. And behold, he also is behind us. Then he commanded also the second and the third and all those who followed the drove, saying, after this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. You shall say, behold, your servant Jacob is also behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So I don't know how many droves there were, but there were more than one or two. So the present passed on before him, while he himself spent that night in the camp. Now he arose that same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. And Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Well, what was Jacob doing to be left alone? Well, either he was there praying, but I think also Jacob had a rather practical bent to him. It's like, Esau's problem is with me, so if I'm all by myself, chances are that Esau will come for me and leave my family and my stuff alone, and they can get away. So he was leaving himself alone, I think, as bait for Esau, in case Esau was still bent on harming him. But instead, a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." But he said, in other words, Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." He said, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." And Jacob asked him and said, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. He already told him his name, right? He said, "You wrestled with God, Israel." And that was, he was the guy who was wrestling. It's like, you know, I would say to somebody who I would wrestle very badly, "Well, you've just wrestled with Pete." And they say, "Well, tell me your name." It's like, "Hello, I just told you." And so, Jacob, God was showing Jacob something with this. And Jacob really, you could tell, what did he want from God? What he wanted from God was not material things or safety, but he said he would not let God go until he blessed him. He was searching urgently for the blessing of God. And he finally got him. And Jacob knew who it was he wrestled. Verse 30, so Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, "I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved." Pan is face, but Peniel is face of God. I've seen God face to face. Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. Therefore this day the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh and the sinew of the hip. This was not a dream. This was not a vision. This is actually a physical action that was going on all night. He was wrestling with this guy, with God. And taught Jacob some things. And God really was proving something to Jacob, because he said that you have wrestled with God and with men. If he'd stopped there, that would be enough. But he said, "and have prevailed." In other words, that you are, in fact, going to be through this, that you're going to be free from this, that it's all going to turn out all right. So God was giving Jacob assurances that he was going to protect Jacob, and he was going to go with him. But I think you need to look at Jacob's attitude. So many times that we come to God really as somebody who has the right to something that God has not promised, that we kind of come storming into God's presence and demand things of God, like God is our servant instead of us being God's servants. It's almost like you go up to the candy machine at work, you're hungry, you put, you know, however much it costs for candy nowadays, I don't buy it out of the machine, it's say 75 cents, you know, ka-plunk, ka-plunk, plunk with the quarters, and you press the button and nothing comes out, you get angry. I put my money in, I want my candy bar, I want my bag of chips. Too many times our prayers are like that. We put our prayers into the God machine, and press the button and nothing happens, and we're upset. We put our money in the machine, we put our prayers in the machine, and want something to come out. And that's not how it's supposed to be at all. And we look at our lives and how very, very much that God has given unto us. And how many times are our attitudes like that of Jacob, who says that I had nothing. I had absolutely nothing. Look what God's done for me. You know, I have some sense of that in my life, looking back, that there are times where if God had not intervened in ways that were very miraculous almost. I use that term very sparingly because, you know, a miracle is really in something that goes against natural law. This is more something, I guess, providential would be a better term for this, where God stepped in directly and stuff happens. That had he not stepped in, things would have wound up quite a bit different than they finally did. There are times when, you know, as they would say in the movies or in books, that our hero looked all washed up, that, you know, roll the credits. You know, like the end of those movie serials that well, I'm probably, you know, not all of you are old enough to even know what I'm talking about, but the old movie serials that used to be in the theaters and on Saturday morning TV, they used to put them at the end of one-week serial, these half-hour things, the hero was hurtling off a cliff, and the bad guys are firing rifles at him. And that was the end. It was stopped. You know, see you next week. To be continued. How in the world are the hero going to get out of that? Well, there have been times in my life where that's happened, and somehow God got me down off the cliff, and I managed not to get hit by any of the bullets, and I wound up not only off on the bottom of the cliff, but far more prosperous than I had any reason to be. And I get angry, like Jonah, just because the sun's too bright, or the air is too dry, or God hasn't done exactly what I expected, and I get upset. We forget where we came from. We forget what the same thing that Jacob said, that we are undeserving of God's gracious gifts to us. But yet, because of God is who He is. I guess we should not strive to live miserable lives. But the lives that we have, we need to be more thankful for what God has done. And to remember that just these little setbacks. Now, I've been thinking about that a lot lately because, you know, I've shared in the prayer time that things have gone awry at work, but yet I think of those people who don't have a job. I think of those people who have to really take a job that really doesn't supply the needs of their families because of circumstances, and people who are desperate. People in the rest of the world, even outside of our country at least has some kind of safety net for people who are without jobs, but think of the abject poverty there in the places of the world. Abject poverty of believers because they are living in countries that are totally hostile to the notion of God, and they can't get work and they can't get a place to live, and people are treating them badly and harassing them all, and I still find things to complain about. It locks me back on my heels, like, how in the world, what chutzpah it is to complain to God. It's like somebody who's been promised $1 million and it comes in as cash and he counts it and it's missing 20 and he's incensed, he's upset, he's angry. Where's my $20? And he forgets the $999,080. I guess $999,980, yeah. And he's upset that he's missing those $20. Man, we really need to cultivate the spirit of gratefulness and an understanding of where we came from. I mean, we do not have a case against God. We do not have a case against God that would stand up in any court, anywhere. We need to continue to live that joyful life of the believer and concentrate instead on all the things, all the blessings that God has given to us, all the wonderful joy it is in serving Him and living in His kingdom, and all the opportunities we have for meaning and service, and all the promises we have for eternal life and the fellowship with God, and just stop being so gloomy. Run to believers that are so gloomy. Don't be gloomy. Instead, look up and rejoice. Be thankful for all that God has given to us. And live that life joyfully that God has given to us. For it's very good. It is very good. No matter what our economic circumstances, it's still better than we deserve. Let's pray. Thank you, O Lord, for all that you have given to us. For all the things that we have are that which was given to us by you. When we give things to you, it's really just giving back some of that which you've already given to us. That our lives are so full. Forgive us for dwelling on the negatives, for dwelling on those things that are not perfect, rather than dwelling on all the wondrous things that you have done for us, all the ways you have intervened in our lives to bless us, to teach us, to give us things that are full of significance and satisfaction. Open our eyes, Father, that we might always see those things that we can enjoy from your hand, and that we would stop focusing so much on those things that are challenges, but rather to accept the challenges as well from your hand, that we might grow and that we might be better conformed to the image of our Messiah, Yeshua. Amen.